All right. So our meeting format calls for a guest speaker followed by open discussion. Our guest speaker will share for between 30 and 45 minutes before calling on people to share. During the open discussion portion of the meeting, we ask that you keep your sharing to, let's call it, five-ish minutes or so. That should be plenty. I suppose we have a nice-sized audience here, so we'll all get a chance to share, I'm guessing. And it's my pleasure tonight to introduce tonight's leader. I had the privilege of running into Joanne at one of, I can't even remember which event it was, but it was a service-related activity in AA, and she had made mention that she was involved in a meeting called the 1728 group and or meeting, and I was intrigued. I hadn't a clue what 1728 meant, and she explained it, and I'll let her tell you too, but in any case, she explained it, and I was really intrigued, and I've really enjoyed being able to participate in that group on Monday afternoons, evenings. So with a great deal of pleasure, I introduce my friend Joanne from Petaluma.
Thank you, Bill. Hi, everyone. I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Joanne. I always start off my shares by saying my sobriety date is June 12, 2002. My home group is the 1728 group, which meets Monday night at 5 p.m. on Zoom. My sponsor's name is Joyce, and I always say all three of those things are vital to my sobriety today. So what does 1728 mean? 1728 is what you get when you multiply 12 by 12 by 12. So it is a group that studies the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, and the 12 concepts of Alcoholics Anonymous. All the spiritual principles that you'd ever want to know are there. And then on the fourth week, we have somebody share their thoughts on a Grapevine article of their choice. And if we have a fifth week, we have a speaker. And I created this meeting over a year ago. I had attended a 1728 group at the General Service Conference. And prior to the General Service Conference, they have this meeting because we have 21 trustees, seven of which are non-alcoholics. And in order to help them understand more about our program, they have this meeting prior to the General Service Conference, and they have somebody speaking about a step, a tradition, and then a concept, and I'm going, that sounds like a great idea, I'm going to try it. And it's been a lot of fun running that meeting, and I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoy it. So yesterday was my AA birthday, and I got to celebrate 19 years of sobriety, and so thank you for allowing me to come and talk, because I can't think of a better way to celebrate a sobriety birthday than to be talking with alcoholics in recovery. I owe my life to Alcoholics Anonymous. I thoroughly, when you read that, the third chapter, all those ways of trying to, I've done it all. I am so convinced I am an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. If it were not for Alcoholics Anonymous, I would be dead from this disease. I believe it is a disease. I believe it is progressive, and I believe it is fatal. And hopefully maybe you'll understand a little bit more when I do tell you my story. Because this is not the first time I've been sober. You know, I have 19 years now, but I have 17 years prior to this. And what I learned from that relapse, I relapsed after 17 years of sobriety, and I was out there for 5 years. And that relapse led me right up to the gates of insanity and death. And I am so grateful today that I did have that relapse, because now I am convinced. I'm convinced more than ever that I have this disease, that the only thing that works for an alcoholic of my type are the 12 steps. I'm also very much convinced today that I need not only these 12 steps for my recovery, I need my home group. My home group I call is my anchor in sobriety. Without my home group, I drift. And that's exactly what happened to me in that first sobriety. I used to have this thing. Every time I'd move in sobriety, I'd get a new sponsor and a new home group. I did that four times. I moved four times. But the last time, I did not get a home group. And that was when I started to slowly, slowly drift away from the program. It wasn't intentional. You know, I didn't think I was cured. I didn't think I didn't need the program anymore. I just never got around to getting that home group. And so that home group to me is so important, and that's why the 12 traditions are so important to me, is because that helps me manage myself within a group of other alcoholics in recovery. And that gives me guidelines for how do I act in this group. And the 12 concepts are how we do our world service throughout the world. You know, this message of Alcoholics Anonymous still needs to be carried to so many people who have not heard about it. And we need to have a service structure in which we decide this is our message. You know, this is what works for us, and how do we carry that? And so being a part of service has been an important part of this this leg of my sobriety. So actually, you know, to tell you the truth about me is I had this disease, I know, from the time I was 15 years old. I was raised in an alcoholic home. There was always booze around our house. And by the time I was 15, I had figured out how to steal my alcohol, because when there was money, there would be a big bottle of Jim Beam on the counter, but when there was no money, there was a big gallon of cheap red wine. And this was typical of my drinking. I figured out as a young kid at 15 how to excuse myself to go wash the dishes, and then I could siphon off a couple big tumblers of whatever there was without anybody knowing it. So right out of the gate, I'm sneaking my drinks, I'm lying about it, and I was very good at it too. So one of my favorite stories I used to tell about my drinking was, when I was 15 also, my parents decided to put a pool at our house. Now, here they have six kids and no money, and they had no business putting in a pool, but the neighbors were putting in pools, so they were trying to keep up with the neighbors, and they put in this pool. So what I would do is I would always do two tumblers, and I would wait till the alcoholics in the house would pass out. Then I would go out in the backyard and go skinny dipping. And what I loved to do was I would put one tumbler at one end of the pool and then put another tumbler at the other end of the pool. And what I loved to do was I loved to go underneath the water and swim underneath the water, come up and get a gulp, and then go back underneath the water, come up and get a gulp. Now, I was skinny dipping, so it was a little erotic and it felt really good. But the real thing about that, how I drank like that, is this. When I was underneath the water, swimming, it was peaceful. It was quiet. There were no alcoholics yelling. There was no blood. There was no puke. There was nobody screaming or throwing things at the wall. It was so peaceful, and I believe that was what I was pursuing in my drinking. I did not know how to shut this up. And 15, I discovered I could shut this up and get to that level of peace by having that alcohol. And that's what I didn't know there were other ways to get that. I only knew that I could get that from drinking, and so from the very early age, that's what I wanted to do. And my disease took off pretty quickly. By the time I was 18, I was probably then drinking on a regular basis. And I know by the time I was 21, I had a very crazy thought at 21 that had been a long time. It's been a long time since I went without a drink. And it was one of those thoughts like, okay, never occurred to me that there was something wrong with that thought. You know, it was just something that just, okay. Because I was a daily drinker. And by the time I was 22 and 23, I was a round-the-clock drinker. I had gotten to a place in my drinking, had progressed to the place where in the mornings my hands would shake, and I would have to have that first drink to quell the shakes. And once I had that first drink, I had no idea what was going to happen the rest of the day. I had no idea if I would be able to control it. I had no idea where I would end up. I could not guarantee my behavior once I put that first drink in me. As soon as I put that first drink in me, the phenomenon of craving, I know that we call it the phenomenon of craving, but it just meant that I wanted another and another and another. And I didn't know how to stop that. So how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was not looking for Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not think alcohol was my problem. You were my problem. If you just treated me better, I wouldn't have to drink like this. I didn't think that I had any issue with alcoholism at all, even though I grew up with it and I saw them drink like that. It was like it wasn't going to happen to me. And at the time when I was 27 years of age, I was working in a restaurant. And guess what happened in this restaurant on Tuesday nights at 8 o'clock? This restaurant would fill up with members of Alcoholics Anonymous. They would come in after this meeting. They would have their pie and their coffee. They would fill the place up. And they were lousy tippers, too. And I used to say, those people in AA, they'll drive you to drink, because I'd always go pour myself a good stiff one before I go wait on them. And wouldn't you know that God knows how to get my attention? There was this one table where it had a bunch of guys in it, and there was a really nice-looking young man. And he kind of thought I was kind of cute, and so he asked me out. And so we were trying to figure out when we could go out, because I worked evenings and he worked a different. So we figured the only time we could go out for a date was for breakfast. And so I felt sorry for this guy, because this poor guy is an Alcoholics Anonymous, so he can't drink. So I thought I was going to do him a favor that morning and not have that morning drink. So we went out for this for breakfast, and I tell you, I remember that day as if it was yesterday. This guy was about 6 years sober. He had worked the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, so he had had a spiritual awakening. He was not only cute, he was funny. He was so much, I had not had that much fun in a long, long time. And I was just having a ball with this guy, even though my hands were shaking, and then, of course, I was, had that lovely aroma that we alcoholics have. So he figured out really quickly that I had a problem with alcohol. I mean, there's that, you know, that I used to think if I took all these showers and bought the most expensive perfumes that nobody could smell it. Well, another alcoholic can smell it, because we know what that smell is. and so he figured out really quickly, and he said, I love you, but I don't think I can go out with you again. And so I remember going home being so dejected, because it wasn't the first time somebody said, I can't go out with you again, because I think, you know, because I think you drink too much. So I had this brilliant idea. I thought, well, maybe I'll ask this guy to take me to a meeting and I'll get another date. Now, I had no idea that you guys had meetings, but somehow I knew you had meetings, so I thought I would ask him about that. So the next time he came into the restaurant, I asked him, and this gentleman, to this day, I'm so grateful for who he is. He looked at me and he said, no, I can't take you to a meeting. He reached into his pocket. He pulled out a card that had a woman's phone number. He said, if you want help for your drinking, you call this woman. And he turned and walked away, which is apparently a very effective method with me when people turn and walk away. Gets my attention. So anyway, that night I went home. And I don't know why that night of all nights, this is in November of 1979, there was a movie about a woman alcoholic on that TV that night. And I am watching this movie, and I'm watching this woman drink on this movie, and I'm watching what happens to her when she drinks, and I'm going, oh, my God, I drink like that. Oh, my God, I felt like that. And I didn't realize what was happening to me at the time was that's the spiritual principle of identification. That's the only thing I know that can break down the denial in me that says I don't have a problem. Is all of a sudden I'm watching going, I do that. Oh, oh. And I had that card. And so I made a decision to call that woman. And she did the exact same thing. She didn't ask me a thing about my drinking. She started telling me about her drinking. And I'm doing the same thing, going, oh, my God, she said that. I did that. And I'm identifying with her. So when she says, do you want to go to a meeting? I said, okay, I'll go to a meeting. And that woman took me to my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and then out for coffee afterwards. And I still to this day remember my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was in San Francisco. We call it the Divine Dump. It was on 1364 Valencia Street. It was everything you think in Alcoholics Anonymous. The steps were written on the wall. They had the winos chuckling around with their trench coats on. I mean, the donuts in the back, the smoke was up to here. I don't remember what I listened to that, but I do remember going to coffee with this woman afterwards, and she explained the program to me. So that I got sober originally in 1979 in November. And I, you know, this woman gave me, she took me through the steps, and the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous transformed my life. I mean, up until this point in time, the only thing I could do was drink. I don't know how I held down a job. I used to say that I never got fired for my drinking because I had one of those uncanny abilities to leave the job before they fired me. I knew that I had a string of unhappy relationships that never, they would go to hell in a handbasket really quickly. And I knew that I moved around a lot, you know, when they talked about the geographics that we would do, because it would always go to hell in a handbasket really quick, and I'd move over here and try it again, and then I'd take me with me, so it all would go to hell in a handbasket really quickly. So I was not very successful at this thing called living. But once I got sober, I found that I could be successful, and I didn't know that about myself. I didn't know that I was smart. I did not know that I didn't even know I was pretty. I just thought I was a piece of garbage. And by being sober, I found out I could do a lot of those things that normal people do. Like, I did go back to school. I did get a good paying job. I had a little bit of problem in the relationship department, but I ended up getting married. We ended up getting a house, having the two kids and, the whole nine yards. And what happened to me was something that I think happens to a lot of people when they get sober young. There is a saying in Alcoholics Anonymous that says, don't let the life that AA gives you get in the way of your AA life. Because that's exactly what happened to me. I got all the stuff, the material stuff, and my life was full. My life was very busy. And like I say, it wasn't intentional that I left Alcoholics Anonymous. It was kind of really gradual, you know, because when you have a job and you have the kids and you have a marriage and you have the PTA and you have ballet, blah, 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 you know, it was full. And there was no time left to get back to the program that had given me my life. And so the day that I picked up, I had no intentions of drinking that day. I woke up just like any other day. And I went out to do laundry, you know. Get out to my laundry room, and there is a bottle of wine sitting in the pantry. And it had been a gift to my husband who doesn't drink, so it had been sitting out in the pantry for 6 years or so. But on this particular morning, I could tell you I hadn't been to a meeting in maybe 7 years. I had no spiritual practices left. Those had kind of gone out of the wayside. We had moved to a new place, so I hadn't managed to make any connection with any members of AA. I had no support around me. And so that morning, when I had that insane thought, because my mind saw the bottle, and the thinking was, oh, it's been a long time since you've had a drink. You could have just two, which is the most insane thought that I could have because I've never had just two. But what was happening is I had no defense against that first drink, and I acted on it, and that took me on a 5-year run. And those 5 years of drinking, it was kind of like nothing really outrageous other than it was like Groundhog Day. Over and over and over. Every day I would wake up, and I didn't say I'd wanted to not drink. I was going to control it. I'm going to control it today, and I'm going to show you. And there's a saying I heard from somebody else that says, when I'm controlling my drinking, I'm not enjoying it. When I'm enjoying my drinking, I'm not controlling it. No matter what, I can't do that. But my life, this obsession took over in my head for that period of time, that I was going to control it, that I could not see anything else that was going on in my life. And like for these 5 years, I had a job, I had a husband, I had 2 kids. And one of my decisions during that period of time, I had a daughter who was used to having a sober, present mother. And she got so angry when I relapsed because I was not there, lights on, nobody home. And she asked me, she was 11 years old, she asked if she could go live with her aunt in Indianapolis. And I said yes, because it was easier for me to drink without looking at her face every day. So my daughter goes leaving. My son was a teenager at the time, and I remember he was so into his stuff, he could care less. But I had my husband who was used to having a sober wife. And so for 5 years, it goes on like that. And what brought me back into the program was not anything of my doing at all. There was no intention to come back and get sober again. I was just going to control it. But I was supposed to go on a trip with my mother. And I've been on trips with my mother before. And this is how you go on a trip with my mother. You get a carry-on case that has pockets on the outside so you can put the half pints, neatly hide them in the outside pockets. Because if you're with my mother, you're going to need them. So my mother and I took off. We were about to go to the airport, and 2 of these half pints were already gone. It was 6 o'clock in the morning, and 2 of them were already gone by the time we get to the airport. And then this was right after 9/11, so the rules had changed, and they confiscated my other 2 pints when we went through customs. And I was a little bit livid. They took my booze. And I remember telling my mom, I'm just going to the bathroom. And that was the last thing I remembered. 12 hours later, I woke up in a hospital in Pacifica. I had a straitjacket on, I had a diaper, and I had an IV, and I had my mother. Well, you were a little combative. The doctors were trying to tell me I had blood alcohol of 0.39, forced death or coma. My blood alcohol was 0.39. They were trying to tell me I was dying. They were trying to tell me I need help. And this is the point of my story, that I don't care if you get anything out of it or not. I need to remember this. Because in that moment in time, I could not hear what they were saying to me. All I knew was I needed a drink. I needed to figure out how to get out of here because I needed a drink. So I told my mom, I said, I think if we catch a cab, we can still make that trip. And my mother, who was a wonderful codependent, called a cab, and I left the hospital. And the next day, I'm on a boat in the Pacific Ocean on a cruise. I have found a bartender that will make me a different martini for 30 days every night. And I am acting like nothing had happened. Our book talks about that part, that we cannot bring with sufficient force the pain and suffering of a day or a week ago. We are without that defense against that first drink. And for me, that defense can only come from a power greater than myself. It can only come from working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember when I came back to meetings, I had one old-timer that I had knew from that first group that I had gotten sober with. And he just looked at me when he heard my story. He says, Joanne, where was your second step? It was non-existent at the time I picked up. And so I went on this cruise, and when I came back from this cruise, you know, I wasn't intending to do anything except for the fact that my husband picked me up. It was a really bad debarkation. We got home, and I decided to go get, I told my husband, honey, I'm going to the deli for sandwiches, which is code word. I need to go get a bottle. My husband, who is not an alcoholic, he's had one meeting of Al-Anon, he let me go. And that night I ended up getting drunk. And the next morning, okay, this is one, my husband with one meeting of Al-Anon. The next morning when he woke up, he looked at me and he said, you know, it's been 30 days since I've seen you. And the first thing you wanted when you came home was a bottle. And he just said, I miss you. And he started to cry. Now, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we talk about these moments of grace. And I believe for me, grace is something that comes outside of me into me that allows me to see the truth. And in that moment in time, I could see that my alcoholism was causing my husband pain. And I would swear to you on a stack of Bibles, I had never seen that look before. I could not see it for those 5 years. But in that moment in time, I could see it. And then the next day when I went to work, I got confronted by my boss. And so it was kind of like the 1-2, boom, boom, and all the defense mechanisms broke down. And if I wanted to keep my job, I had to come back into recovery. And I can tell you, I was one angry person coming back into recovery. I wasn't looking for sobriety. I didn't know if I wanted it. I just knew I had to have it right now to keep my job. But what it really was my pride. I was so afraid of being judged coming back into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was so ashamed of having 17 years and then not taking care of what would people think of me when I came back into the rooms. My pride was the one thing that was rearing its ugly head, trying to keep me out there. And what I found when I came back into the rooms is nobody said, well, what a loser you are. You know, look what you gave up. Everybody said, oh my God, welcome back. Thank God you didn't die. Thank God you didn't die. And it was, I found somebody to take me through the steps again. And what it was I had built up a lot of resentment sober. Oh, my God. When I did my fourth step, there was so many amends I did not want to make. Because I wanted to continue to blame you. That was my thing. I wanted to blame you for my unhappiness. I did not want to take responsibility for my life. And what happened was I had a wonderful sponsor that says, pray for the willingness. Pray for the willingness. And I kept praying and I kept praying. And until one time I was in a meeting and the first person on my list I needed to make amends to walked in the meeting. And in that moment in time, the willingness was there. And I was able to make that first amends where I got to own my part and they got to own their part. And the relief from that amends was so amazing to me that spearheaded me on with making the rest of my amends and having that spiritual awakening where I got to see that if I'm unhappy, it's me. The answers are always within me. If I am disturbed, there is something wrong with me. And I became a real advocate for the 10th step because that was something that I had lost in my first sobriety. I didn't continue to take personal inventory. That was one tool that went out the window. And today that step is so important to me. It's important for my sobriety. It's important to my peace of mind. It's important to keep my side of the street clean. I never valued peace of mind before. I was constantly living in the past and reliving every little thing that you ever did to me and how you did this and what an asshole you were and blah, 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 blah. I didn't know that you can shut that stuff up by working these steps. by looking inside, by forgiveness, by letting go and letting God. And so my sobriety coming back was coupled with service to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got involved very early on in being of service to my home group. And eventually that led to being a general service rep for my group. And I found out in general service that it talks about, there's a beautiful thing in our service manual that says, why do we need a general service conference? And it says, we don't need it for us because we have sobriety, we have our literature, everything's okay for us. What we need it for is to ensure that, our steps, our traditions, and our concepts will be there for the alcoholic that's still out there drinking. Like the person that hasn't found us yet. They have one line that says, the child that's being born today destined for alcoholism. That's why we have a conference. And what had occurred to me when they were reading that for the first time, I got this realization that while I was out there drinking, my drinking was 5 years, and then maybe another 5-7 years I was not in AA. While I was out there, somebody took care of Alcoholics Anonymous so it would be there for me when I came back. Somebody took care of it to not change the steps or the traditions or the book. Somebody took care of it, and then I had this realization that it was my turn. It's my turn to take care of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've been doing that ever since. I served in general service for 14 years. I rotated out a couple of years ago as the Panel 67 delegate. And I'm still very active in California Northern Coastal Area, serving as the finance chair for the finance committee right now. The other thing is I sponsor tons of women right now. And that was a missing component for me in my first sobriety. I did not sponsor. And now I get to have this gift of trying to give it away. It gets given back to me tenfold. So I think that's about all I want to say, except I want to close with something that I usually close with when I speak. And it's not from AA literature, but it's from The Course in Miracles, which is something that's very near and dear to my heart. And it goes like this. It says, give thanks for mercy and the love of God. Rejoice in the power of forgiveness to heal your sight completely. Be confident that on this day there is a new beginning. Without the darkness of the past upon your eyes, you cannot fail to see today. And what you see will be so welcome that you will gladly extend this day forever. Thank you for letting me share.
Wow, that was fantastic, Joanne. Thank you so much for sharing so much of your experience with us. We are now going to start the discussion part of the meeting. Our meeting does go till 9 o'clock, so we've got some time to fill, and we would like to hear from as many different people as possible. So I'm going to turn the meeting back over to Joanne to pick on people who can contribute to our conversation tonight. So back to you, Joanne.
Hey, well, anybody want to talk? I was thinking of talking, if you need a subject, I was thinking of grace. Go ahead.
Hi, Joanne. Hi, my name is Catherine, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
And happy birthday to you. And thank you so much for your sharing. I believe that there are no coincidences in AA. And part of what you had quoted earlier comes from Crossing the River of Denial out of the stories in the back of the Big Book. And I met with my sponsees before attending this meeting, and we read that chapter tonight. And so there was that moment of, I really needed to hear that because God told me it twice within an hour. So I really must have needed to hear what you and what he had to say. And, you know, I was sharing with the gals, and I was sharing with them that at the very end of my drinking, I could not find the grace to fill that space between the impulse and the action. The thought would cross my mind and I would take action, take a drink, take a drug, do whatever. And every, you know, there were so many mornings when I would wake up and say, not today. I'm not going to do it again today. Today is going to be different. And then 4 hours later, lunchtime comes and I'm off to the races. And because I had no grace, I had nothing to buffer the thought to the action. And so it was just again and again and again and again and again. And, you know, I appreciate your sharing about your relapse. I have fallen away from AA. I still sponsor women. I still go to meetings. I still have a sponsor, but I'm not in it. I'm not in the middle of AA. And I just made a major change in my life, and I recognized that I wouldn't have been in the situation to make the change. Although it's a good change, I wouldn't have needed to make a change if I had been working the steps. If I had been working the steps on my relationship with my boss and the people at work, I wouldn't have had the desire to go looking for a new job. And so I went looking for a new job, and I got a new job, and it's a great new job, and I start that job tomorrow. But that new job is taking me away from my family. And that new job is in a city 2.5 hour flight away from home. And, you know, checked it out with my husband, checked it out with my kids, checked it out with my sponsor. But it occurred to me that if I was in the middle of AA, it occurred to me that if I was doing my 10 step on a daily basis, it occurred to me that if I was showing up and being honest with how I was feeling about that relationship with my boss, that maybe I wouldn't have been interested in finding a new job, right? Now, I know that God has provided for me in my career in a way that I could have never imagined. I had hundreds of people tell me how sad they were that I was leaving my old job. That doesn't happen to an alcoholic like me, right? It doesn't happen to an alcoholic like me. And, you know, I'm thinking, you know, as I'm going into this new role, what am I going to do different, right? Because if I keep showing up afraid to say what's on my mind, I was thinking about this, that I'm a, I act like a teenager. I act like, and I have to say, I'm a senior executive of a $2.5 billion company, right? So I'm not, there's an expectation that I'm a mature adult, and I show up as a teenager over and over and over again, right? I started drinking when I was 10 or 11, and sometimes I show up as that bratty little teenager. And, you know, the thought that comes to my mind is, I never wanted to ask my parents for permission, because if they said no, then I was going to defy them anyway. So what I've learned over time is, just don't ask for permission. Just do what you want to do and then deal with the consequences. And that's the behavior that I had been doing since I'm a teenager. And through all of my step work, yes, defiance and problems with authority, you know, all of that stuff came out. I sobered up in 1994, so I've got a couple of 24 hours underneath me. And here I am, you know, 28 years old, 28 years later, and the light bulb goes on. I'm still acting like a damn teenager. And I don't want to ask for permission, because if you say no, then what am I going to do with that? And I don't want to tell you what I'm thinking, because then what if you don't like me? Or what if you are thinking something different and I don't like you now? And it's hysterical. I mean, it's sad. It's sad. But it's, you know, I tell the women that I sponsor, you know, when they have these aha moments, it's when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And I'm open to, am I going to finally grow up? I'm 53 years old. Am I going to finally grow up and stop being a bratty teenager? Because it gets me in trouble again and again and again and again. But I really appreciate your share, and I really, you know, wish you the best. And I thank you so much for calling out that piece of the big book. And now I got to go back and read it a third time, because I know that God is trying to tell me something. So with that, I'll pass. Okay.
My name is Karen, and I'm an alcoholic. Hopefully you're still asking for volunteers, Joanne. thank you so much. I wish I'd written down everything that you said so eloquently. I just thoroughly enjoyed your story, and I think I've met you before in general service. The first thing, I really appreciate your humble example of drinking again after many years of sobriety. I think sometimes those of us that are blessed enough to have double digit numbers get that stinking thinking feeling that, well, drink isn't the problem. It's all my relationships that are the problem. So thank you for reminding me that alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful. And I think if Bill had waited to write the book now, he would have said patient. Very patient, just always sitting there waiting. I love the part about when we first started drinking. I didn't start drinking until I was 32. And I'll tell you, it was my best friend. It was the solution to all my problems. And I loved it. And it was wonderful. I used to keep stickies in my drawer in my bedroom, and I'd be drinking and, you know, solving all these worldly problems and everybody else's problems and all the problems on the news, and I'd wake up after passing out. I thought I was going to sleep, but I was passing out, and I would read these stickies, and they didn't make any sense. And how could they not make any sense when just a couple hours ago they solved everything? And that was part of my insanity of thinking, you know, I was so powerful in doing everything. And I try to think sometimes, when did it turn on me and stop being my best friend and start being my biggest problem? And I think it was around, I recall different things at different times, but probably about 7 or 9 years, and I drank for 19. And so I really appreciate you sharing that I need to be aware that if I stop my spiritual program, that's one of the outcomes. And I'm so glad you didn't die, and you certainly could have, and that's a pretty fatal outcome. The other thing I heard you talk about was balance, and balance in life, balance of program, and balance of my relationship with God and my relationship with my family, and being of service. And what I've discovered for me, this is just my experience, is that balance changes for me as I get older. And things change. And, change is the only constant, is such a condition that I understand today. And Catherine was talking about, you know, the, I hope that's not, talking, you know, over, if that we're okay to mention other people's names in a meeting. is, oh gosh, that was a great thought and it just passed, but I guess it'll come back if it's really important. Is that, you know, I keep thinking in change that things will stay the same, and they don't. They don't. And as my body gets older, I'm not old, but I am older. And as my body gets older, my mind doesn't get older. And that immature thinking is still there, you know, ready for me at any moment. So change is part of acceptance that maybe I can't do everything that I thought I could do once before. And I have to ask for divine guidance in order to proceed, you know, with the rest of my life. And that guidance changes in what direction I'm supposed to go and how I'm supposed to be of service. I think one of the greatest gifts for me for Alcoholics Anonymous is at 51 coming into program, I was still a victim. I was still that little kid victim of all the traumas that happened to me as a child. I'm the typical alcoholic. Not many of us. I haven't heard a whole lot of people come into alcoholics saying, my childhood was so wonderful. Every once in a while, I hear one of those. But for the most part, what I hear is we had a lot of trauma. And we are a victim. I was a victim. A child is a victim of different kinds of abuse. But as a 51-year-old, you think you're still a friggin' victim? No, you're not. You're choosing to be a victim. You're choosing to do that. And I think that's one of the things you talked about, Joanne, is that in the first step, I realize that I am powerless. And all of these resentments that I have are killing me spiritually and are keeping me from growing. So I so thank you for reminding me of that and bringing that to light and your enthusiasm. And you just remind me again that, you know, what you talked about were tragic, tragic, tragic things, and yet we laugh at them. And we don't laugh because they're funny. We laugh because we know what that was like, and we're not there anymore. We're with our tribe. We're with our people. And that to me, is the grace of a higher power. So thank you so much for letting me share, and thank you so much for agreeing to be here tonight. Really appreciate it, and appreciate Bill and all he's doing. And I'm so sorry we lost the New Hope group. I was hoping that they would get a chance to share, because they're the ones that need this just as much as I do today. So thank you.
Thank you.
I know somebody out there is dying to share. Anthony. Anthony, I think you're muted.
Okay. Yeah, I'm okay. My phone keeps on I'm charging my phone, and right now it's on very low power, so I had to put charge it right now. But yeah, I'm an alcoholic. October 15th was my last drink of 2020. Yeah, and I'm happy. I'm pushing through, you know, and thanks to coming to the meetings and to, you know, and to share what we're doing, you know, and that our higher power is working in our lives, you know, and even through all the, like, the things that we go through, we got to put him first and know that he once we put our trust into our higher power and know that you leave it all into His hands, that we're basically we're powerless, you know what I mean? And give it all to Him, you know, and let Him take charge for us and let Him control what we need done down here for us, you know, and let Him handle everything because, you know what, at the end of the day, He's the one that has the last say, so not us, you know. And I know that if we put our faith and trust in Him, all things are possible, you know. I'm just temptation. I'm dealing with a lot of temptation. I see a lot of beer cans, and so it's coming to that. You know what I mean? It's October of last year, and I'm seeing beer cans more often, and I'm picking them up, and I'm saving them. And I'm thinking of a different way of, not to dwell on wanting to drink, not to dwell on wanting to have a sip and to do things like that. You know, I'd rather just, be more obedient and, I give my higher power all the glory, you know, and I'm really thankful. I'm grateful. I'm content, you know, I'm very, 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 very happy. And when I crave, I have cravings. I don't know what that craving, but I have cravings, and it's not more of a it's like a thirst kind of a thing. But once I start reading, or I put my mind into doing something like more for my soul, my spirit, and for my well-being. Things just like everything, like you feel like you're surrounded by like 100 and millions of people. You just dive into the word, or you dive into your reading, and just like everything just goes away. You know what I mean? Everything just disappears. But you know, it's just like, and you just, I get into it, and it's just like, you know, I'm just like, I give it all to you, you know, and I leave it in your hands. And we just go about our day, you know. And if I can help someone out to not drink and to not to fall back into drinking, I'd be real happy that if it was because of a inspirational word, or because I said something that maybe was touching their spirit, you know, or touching their heart that day, you know. Hey, I'm happy. You know what I mean? I did my job. You know, I did something, you know, and I'm happy. And, you know, and relationship-wise, too, I can see as me being separated for over four and a half years, going on 5 years, and I'm married but separated, you know, and I'm learning that, hey, you know what, maybe things happen the way they do because I have to, you know. Now I have to learn how to treat a lady, to learn how to do things, you know, the right way, and you know, open the door for her, you know, pull the chair out for her, you know, things like that, you know. And I'm learning, you know. I remain teachable. I keep my mind to remain teachable and to learn, you know, because you guys have a lot of inspirational things that I like to hear, you know. And I, whatever touches my heart, and I take it, you know, and I run with it. You know what I mean? I run with it throughout my day. And if we can make somebody happy through our groups and do things like that, then we're doing what we have to do. You know, and we're breaking those chains. And we come together, and all things are possible. You know, all things are possible. And I don't want to feel like I'm a blabbermouth or just blabbing, but I know that if we put all, like, nervousness and all that stuff to the side, and put on courage and you know, and boldness and meekness, gentleness, you know, put the whole thing on and go about our day, you know. And don't let the enemy take your joy. Don't let somebody take your joy. What makes you happy, don't let somebody take that from you. And you know what I mean? Because that's what makes you happy. If it makes you happy, then, you know, don't let the enemy take that from you. You know, and all we can do is go higher. You know what I mean? Our bar is set at a certain level, and all we can do is go higher. You know, we reach that bar. Hey, you know what? Set it up a little bit higher, because now we got to go higher. You know what I mean? And it's, man, Yeah, but other than that, I'm happy. You know what I mean? I'm happy. There's days where I'm sad. There's days where, you know, I'm just all in awe. You know, but I know that God works.
I'm thinking we must have lost Anthony. We do have Joe and Anthony W. With us. I know Mike was just recording for us. He's not able to. He doesn't have a path to talk into our meeting. So there are just Joe and Anthony W. who remain. If either of you would like to add to the conversation, we'd love to hear from you.
Hi, my name is Joseph, and I'm an alcoholic and addict, as well as plenty of other things. What was the topic again? I'm sorry.
The topic is grace.
Grace. So I can't really say that I understand fully what grace is, I guess. I've enjoyed listening to everyone speak right now. What if you were to define grace, what would be a definition of that real quick?
A free gift from God.
Okay. Well, when you put it like that, the first thing that comes to mind is just free will, you know? And I think about all the decisions I've made and continue to make. And that is, you know, and a lot of bad decisions, you know, bad decisions, and that's what's kind of gotten me here, you know, as well as some good ones. And then as far as it comes with the alcoholism, you know, that I feel like, you know, I'm not sure if I fully understand the grace. I'm sorry about that. But I know just being willing to make my own mistakes, and being able to still be here to continue to make those mistakes and to learn from them, I'm very grateful and happy for that. Just having you guys around to listen to, even while I'm sitting here working, it's nice to have you guys in my ear and just to know that other people have it worse than I do. You know, I'm sure that's not the best thing to say, but sometimes it's an eye opener, you know, to know that I'm not the only one who has problems, and some of my problems are pretty minor in comparison to others, as well as my alcoholism. You know, I've been fortunate to not have any DUIs, to, you know, not ever been in a crash involving alcohol or anything like that, and I hear stories like that, and it's not that I haven't put myself in those situations. I'm notorious for driving around with a 12-pack and you know, and then picking up another 12-pack when I stop to, you know, use the restroom at the liquor store and just keep on going. It's been a while since I've done that, but I mean, I'm very grateful for the fact that I don't, you know, that I've made it through those things, and listening to your guys' stories and listening to some other stories too about people who didn't actually get to make it out of those situations, that's what keeps me coming back here. Just thinking that I need to really be thankful for what the Lord, or at least my Lord, has given me, and he's kept me here for a reason. And there's been a lot that's gone on in this last past year for me, a lot of great things. And for that, I'm very, very grateful. And I still feel like I'm off topic. I'm so sorry about that. But I'm just speaking. I know we're trying to fill the time, and I'm one of the guys left on the board here. And I could stop for a minute, and just kind of speak on it. But, with that, I'm just going to let it go. And I'm thankful for everyone that shows up, you know, for these meetings, because it does help me, you know, even if I don't show myself or, do know that I'm always listening. And, that's mainly what I'm here trying to do right now, is just listen and, pull things away, from these meetings. So I'm very grateful for everyone here. And with that, I'll let it go. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
Thanks, Joe. Hey, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Bill, and I'll go ahead and jump in. And, you know, Joe, Karen was talking about crosstalk, and I'm gonna commit that crime right now, and I'm gonna tell you something, Joe. For somebody that claims to not really understand grace, you sure talked about it well.
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny because, you know, when I was early in my exposure to AA and, you know, trying to figure out this weird culture that you people have, you know, I remember being at a meeting and I felt really good about contributing to the conversation. I felt like I really added some valuable insight to the discussion, and my sponsor was with me at that meeting, and we walked outside, and he looked at me and he goes, "What in the hell was that?" He said, "You were a gibbering idiot." So Joe, you were not a gibbering idiot. You were exactly the opposite of, you know, what I ran into. I was pretty mixed. I think I was actually drinking the night before that meeting, too, which probably didn't help. But, you know, Joanne, thank you so much for being here. What a neat thing that we would accidentally ask you to come and share, on the anniversary of your 19th year and first day, right? I mean, that is providential, I think. You know, you were talking about your story, and I found myself, as I have so many times in the past, thinking, that didn't happen to me, that didn't happen to me, that didn't happen to me, you know, and it's so easy for us to identify the things that are different among us, and it really, you know, so I caught myself thinking, oh, well, that's different. That's, oh, wait a minute. What do they say in AA? They say, look for the similarities. And, what crossed my mind is that, you know, the mechanics of, how we got to today, where we are just today, for each of us today, how we got here mechanically, probably looks a bit different for all of us. You had something I would characterize as a very, what I think of anyway, is a very traditional sort of 12-step call. Somebody in AA ran across your path and thought, this person could probably use some help. Let me direct them, right? And that's really not exactly what happened to me. I made, you know, one more mess out of my life than I could get away with, and I was surrounded by the people who loved me at a very early hour of the day in my house. They converged upon my house to surprise me. I got a surprise party finally, but there were no bounce houses and no ponies. It was you know, an intervention is what it was, and my family asked me to accept their offer of help and to go away and meet some people who could maybe help me, and so funny thing, you know, the mechanics of that interaction were different between you and I, but the net result was the same thing. We both ended up, you know, being directed to an AA meeting. And I was thinking about how you were saying that with that bottle of wine that you would just have two drinks. I'm just going to have two drinks. And I thought, you know, I don't know if I ever said that, but you know what I do remember saying a lot of is, hey, check it out. I'm going to get sober tomorrow because today I'm drinking. You know, the trouble with that, I found is that I never got sober tomorrow. Never, ever, ever. I still have never been sober tomorrow, right? It's always getting sober today. But those are funny little lies that we tell ourselves. And you also said you couldn't hear what other people were saying, right? The people were apparently speaking to you, trying to get your attention about this problem that they perceived that you had. And you know, I didn't remember anybody ever saying before this intervention thing. And I'll never forget. I got out of treatment and I came home and I started drinking again. And one of my best friends from high school, he wasn't actually part of the intervention, but he knew about it and he was involved in, I think he came and visited me in treatment, at one point. So he was involved in the process. When I got back home, I remember sitting on my front lawn with a beer in hand, convincing him, telling him, you know, that, yeah, you know, the, some of the other things I was doing, which were certainly, you know, more illegal were clearly, you know, problematic, but the drinking, come on. I mean, drinking can't possibly be a problem. And I told him, you know, if I could find evidence that the drinking was a problem, because I didn't have any DUIs, I didn't have, you know, anything that would really point to alcohol being a problem. If I could find, you know, evidence of a problem, I would certainly be willing to reconsider my point of view. And he just looked at me and he was just dumbfounded that I could say something so ridiculously stupid. Because as he reminded me, he had told me many, many times that I had a problem, but I couldn't hear it, you know? And he reminded me that I actually, you know, went to jail one time and I went in front of a judge one time because of my drinking. You know, but I couldn't hear it. So I related to you on that level too. And then you were talking about how you didn't want to make amends, and you said what I heard was, you know, this idea of making amends meant that you were going to have to be responsible for your actions, right? And not just the actions that you took, but the actions that you take going forward. And that reminded me of just how powerful I felt as a victim. You know, as long as I could tell people stories about how other people had gotten in my way or had outright harmed me, that and I have a real craft for telling the story in just the right way, right, to get your support for my side of the story, right? You know, as long as I could stay in that position of as a powerful victim, then there was no, or there was less incentive for me to change and not grow up, you know, and not be responsible for myself, as long as I could point out other people's matters. And your topic today was grace. What I think Joe said without saying it, or maybe said it a different way than I'm going to say it, but is this idea of unmerited favor. Right? Like this forgiveness that I seem to be able to get, or this, this lack of consequence that I ought to face, but that I get relieved from, for no good reason. I was thinking about this example. One of my friends, every time he even smelled liquor, he would, and get in the car, he would get arrested. I mean, I'm exaggerating, of course, but I mean, every time he was drinking and driving, he got busted. And I can't, I mean, I did have the one incident that I mentioned earlier, but I mean, clearly there was a radical departure from the number of times I got in trouble and the number of times I should have gotten in trouble. And he used to get really, really angry at me because I didn't get in trouble. And he always did. And I struggled for a while to figure out why it was that I didn't get in trouble. And I don't know that I have any good answer for that. One thing that, I've kind of made a little bit of sense out of, although it's not entirely true, is this idea that, you know, not having a lot of that wreckage, I haven't had as much difficulty as some people do in getting approved to take AA into institutions. And so I kind of feel like maybe this is just such a ridiculous way of looking at it, but sometimes I kind of talk myself into thinking that maybe I didn't get into trouble so much as I should have, so that I could go and help others in these places where it can sometimes be hard to get in when you've been in trouble. And but the thing that made me think about that is that my willingness to do that work happened long after I didn't face the consequence, right? So not getting into trouble was something that happened way before anything I could have done that might have warranted that. So again, just the idea of unmerited favor, that good things in my life that I haven't earned, right? I'm in sales, I'm in technology sales, and so I got to a point where I think of it like this. It's like, you know, I can do a good job or I can do a bad job in fostering a relationship with a prospective customer. And that's clearly on me. But I have yet to figure out how to manipulate the universe in just the right way to create demand for what I do. So I may have a great product that I can offer, you know, anybody, but I can't make people need what I offer. That's got to come from some power infinitely greater than me. And it's a great way for me to think about humility. That, you know, because I mean, I've been very fortunate in the work that I do. I've been compensated very well for having very successful years of work and a lot of the accolades that go along with it, and you know, it's easy to be at work when your things are going well, right? And it hasn't always gone well, yeah, I don't know where I was going with that, other than I guess just this idea of the grace, right? Just the unmerited favor that seems to happen. And I've talked quite long enough now, so I'm going to be quiet. But thank you so much for being here, Joanne. I'm so glad that we had some others show up and contribute to the conversation. So thanks, everybody.